from the UK to being European Capital of Culture 2008. So on the morning the announcement was made, I was watching the BBC, and the minister concerned made the announcement. The UK nomination for European Capital of Culture is Liverpool. And I was, as you can imagine, quite taken aback and shocked. My first thought is that's the end of my career. My job is now gone because I have nothing to research. So what do you do in a moment of crisis? You call your mother. So I called my mother and she said, don't worry, just get the same job in Liverpool. And I said, that's not how jobs work in universities, Mum, but thanks for the advice. Anyway, 2 years later, sure enough, I'm working at the University of Liverpool in the very job that my mother recommended for me. What I want to say about the model, I'm going to approach the model in a very different way to Cliff, I think, but sort of come to some similar conclusions. And the first thing that I want to say is that the model acknowledges, obviously, that the city is a highly complex and contradictory phenomenon. And the a concern for any model of this kind is whether or not it's capable or suited to understand and make sense of that complexity and to take the city in a new direction in some way or the other. And incidentally, I think it's very important that we talk about cities rather than the city. And that's sort of the broad theme of what I'm going to say. The complexity of cities is such that it's quite awkward and misleading to talk about the city in the first place. So that is my question. Is it possible to manage the transformation of the city? Is it possible to systemize a phenomenon that, by its very nature, is highly dynamic, highly unpredictable? And all these questions may well have formed part of the development of the Corbett model up until the stage that we've reached today. But for such a model to be convincing and to be effective, we need to consider a bit more carefully, I think, the diversities of place, space, and the actors that Cliff drew attention to earlier that that characterise the contemporary city or cities. So a concern of mine about the Corbett model is that although it professes the need for an interdisciplinary approach, it's so fundamentally rooted in an approach concerned with competitiveness that its view of the city may not be flexible enough to incorporate the diversities of life in city in cities. Sorry, it's the model may not be complex itself enough to be to adequately comprehend social, cultural, economic, and environmental guises of contemporary city life. Okay, so what I want to suggest, and obviously my ideas come from very much my experience of the British world of regeneration, if you like, and a key implication, I think, of debates going on in Britain at the moment is that actually what's emerging is what I call the rhetorical city. In other words, our vision of the city is being determined by the way in which policymakers perceive the future of that city. So policymakers are very much reproducing a vision of the city that appeals to the idealised consumer. That is not about the social, the economic realities of the city, but is about moving forward to some idealised reality where everybody can consume this perfect, wonderful space for consumption. And what's being created here then is very much a uniform vision of the city. And it's interesting to see where a model such as the Corbett model fits into this process. Is there a danger that such a model just reinforces the uniformity of what cities are potentially becoming? And another key concern of mine is that discussions about cities are all too often ahistorical. They've actually had paid no attention at all to the historical development of cities as place. And it was certainly a concern of mine reading the model that it's clearly very connected to the present of the city and the future of the city, but it's almost entirely, at least on the surface, unconnected to the past of the city. It makes an oblique reference to sort of the deindustrialised past, but it doesn't really engage with that in any serious way. And I would suggest you cannot understand the present of the city without contemplating the past. If you want to create a sustainable city, then the historical element is essential to that. And my broad theme of what I'm saying really is that there's continuous discussions in the UK about creating the future of cities, and there's almost a blind assumption that all cities can be these competitive, successful, consumer-centred spaces and places. And that clearly isn't the case. And whether that or not that works depends upon the historical aspects of that particular city. So often, the success or the competitiveness, if that's the word we should use, of a city depends upon its success in solidifying its links with the past. And the problem here is that too often the vision of the city that is adopted by policymakers is founded upon this uniform, consumer-driven future. So the vision in the UK, I am generalising here really to make a point, but the sort of primary vision seems to be of the city as an entity that attracts tourists, that attracts private funding, and in particular one that promotes culture, or various definitions of culture, as being a driving force in regeneration. And one of the reasons for this is the work of this guy. I call him an urban evangelist. He's like a religious guru. Certainly as far as British policymakers are concerned, he is the god of regeneration. And Richard Florida and his work, particularly the book The Rise of the Creative Class, has really had a fundamental impact on how policymakers are viewing the future of the city. And Richard Florida presents this way out for what you might describe as failing cities. He suggests that the way forward is to attract creative people to cities through providing an effective cultural offer. And as such, what he does is he makes all the noises that policymakers want to hear. He allows policymakers to think big, because no policymaker in their right mind would think, my city can't be creative, my city can't be cultural. So it appeals to the sort of innate way that politicians and policymakers think about the world in which they live. Now, not intentionally, but by accident, what Florida does is that he implies culture or creativity-led regeneration is an easy option. And that obviously is a mistake to make. He doesn't argue that all cities can be archetypal creative cities, but by identifying a pecking order, by using sort of league tables of creativity, he creates this aspirational model that everybody wants to tap into. So the problem with Florida's work, in my opinion, is that creativity and culture, and by implication you might say competitiveness, are presented as a universal assessment of the urban problem, and constitute this effort to present prescriptive solutions to the developing city. And this is my concern in the context of the Corbett model. Is it, you know, we need to start from a point to consider, is it possible to prescribe the future of cities? I'm not saying that the model is trying to do that, but is there a danger it falls into that trap? So other authors in this field, such as David Harvey, have identified historically a sort of broader shift from urban governance to a shift and interest in from managerialism to entrepreneurialism. And that, as a result, what's been constructed is an environment based around private-public partnerships, which focuses on investment and economic development, and therefore on the speculative construction and development of urban space. And sorry to impose a rather lengthy quotation on you, but I think this is a useful way of thinking about what we're talking about here. And this is a quotation from Gibson and Cocker. Rather than present alternative ways of imagining regional futures, what seems to be happening is that a singular interpretation of creativity is being incorporated into a rather uncreative framework, in which private sector solutions to regional problems, the ideal of creative, independent, entrepreneurial subjects, and the primacy of place competition in global markets remains paramount. It demonstrates how neoliberal ideology operates as a normative framing of economic relations, even co-opting and subsuming ideas that intuitively appear to challenge its orthodoxy. So my concern here again is that of this imposition of a particular view of the city that underestimates its diversity, when the diversity of the city or cities is actually its very quality, the essence of the city that we need to be encouraging, not dismissing through the imposition of any particular, I'm not saying the Corbett model, but any particular view of what cities should be doing. So broadly then, my concern is the whole debate, certainly in Britain, around culture, creativity, etc., is simply a proxy for consumption. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm currently involved in a research project called Impact 08, and it's the biggest research project yet to look at the social, cultural, economic impact of European capital of culture. Now, the role of culture in Liverpool, with it being European capital of culture in 2008, is obviously highly debated. And many critics of what's happening in Liverpool at the moment describe the city not as the capital of culture, but as the capital of regeneration. And because this sort of feeling, this criticism of European capital of culture, comes out of the feeling that what's going on is a redesign, a re-imaging of the city, mainly aimed at attracting middle-class professionals who are more concerned with the cafe culture of Liverpool than with the culture of a city steeped in history in whatever shape or form. Now, the problem here is that in Britain, policy has gone down this culture-led regeneration line without absolutely any evidence whatsoever that it worked. The Department of Culture, Media and Sport in the UK have no idea whether this kind of regeneration is successful. They are flailing about not knowing whether this is the way forward. And the success stories that are used to justify such an approach are highly questionable. One such example is Glasgow, the first European city to use the title at that time, City of Culture, as a means of urban renaissance. It's often sort of presented as this great success story, but in reality, it created as many problems as it did advantages. And as various authors, such as Ronan Patterson being one of them, have indicated, often the success stories attached to this sort of a regeneration approach use the notion of culture to sort of camouflage the realities of very divided populations. And very often, the focus of such regeneration, as has already been mentioned earlier, has been on the city centre, of the downtown areas being the sort of shop window of the city. And my concern is, if competitiveness goes down that line, What does the city in its broader conception become? Is it simply a storeroom full of dilapidated, worn-out shop dummies who are misused and have no use? Because the city, the shop window of the city, is all that matters. And the doomsday scenario in this situation is one where you've got a rapidly regenerated, gentrified urban core, and this core being surrounded by intensely disadvantaged residential areas. That's the doomsday scenario that has happened in the past and will no doubt happen in the future. So the discourse, I mean, this is really what I'm talking about, a discourse, a rhetorical view of the city that predominates. If it continues to present this positive economic view of the city, and perhaps a view that's unintentionally presented within the Corbett model itself, a vision that promotes the city as a centre of consumption, what that will do will promote a city that's exclusive and not inclusive. So such an approach may have the unintended consequence of providing nothing more than a temporary solution to the problems of the deindustrialised city. That this vision of the consumer city may perpetuate the instability of the city. And the experience that we had in the UK, certainly around the nomination process, I mean, it was a frantic competition between six cities, ultimately, to get the nomination as European Capital of Culture, illustrates the rhetorical nature of the city, because it allowed local governments to redefine their city based on the flimsiest of evidence, whilst sort of fueling what is already in the UK a highly uncomfortable relationship with regeneration that already exists. And I want to sort of highlight that fact that obviously we all realise that regeneration is not a solvable solution and often causes more problems than it does solutions. But I want to briefly talk about somebody's work I think is really, really effective in making us think about these issues. And that's the work of Richard Williams, who describes regeneration in England as being a particularly uncomfortable experience. Because in England, we have what he calls an anti-urban culture. And Williams discusses the impact of gentrification. And I think one point I should raise is that in the Corbett model, the model almost seems to imply or even romanticise the notion of gentrification as this organic process led by artists and creators. Whereas often in the UK, when we think about gentrification, certainly from a sociological point of view, it's sort of a negative word. We're concerned about the sort of the fallout of gentrification. And I think that is not quite recognised within the model. But Williams argues not that gentrification has produced a strengthened culture, but actually the reverse. That so many of the city's new residents have no need for the collective services that the city provides, its schools, healthcare, public transport, that public space in the city has inevitably declined as a result. And not surprisingly then, Richard Williams argues that the city in the UK is ultimately underpinned by its class dimension. I won't read the whole quotation out, but I think the key aspect of this is in the middle of the quotation. What we're describing here, this revolution, is a revolution of bourgeois taste, which excludes that of the working class as traditionally defined, and also that of the aristocracy, such as it still exists. It exists in tension with these other kinds of tastes and with the other attitudes to the urban that underpin them. So we have this vision of regeneration in the UK, iconic forms of new architecture, a culture, consumption-driven world that actually divides the city more than it can ever hope to provide for that city. And it's in this light that cities such as Liverpool, where I'm currently working, have what Richard Williams calls a very anxious relationship with the city and with regeneration. And this is perhaps best exemplified by an example that Richard Williams, I'll get there eventually. The example that Williams uses is the Albert Dock. I don't know how many people have actually been to Liverpool, but basically, the Albert Dock is sort of at the very core of Liverpool's, what you might call, industrial past. But from the 1950s onwards, the Albert Dock was unable to maintain its economic function for very simple, straightforward reasons, that it wasn't big enough to take the size of ships that were being developed at that time. So in the 1980s, the Albert Dock was redeveloped with the Tate Gallery, the Tate Art Gallery, at its core. And so public funds were used to lever in private capital. But what happened, according to Williams, was a misguided attempt to try and sort of impose a view of regeneration on the city and create like this new regenerated space, to create like a symbol of regeneration that had very little impact on the broader city. And what you have now in the Albert Dock is shopping up, sort of fairly, on the whole, low-end shopping opportunities, a few designer bars, eating and drinking opportunities. And according to Williams, what this represents is a manifestation of the picturesque. Okay, so a response to the urban problem, not a response that seeks to solve the main characteristics or the causes of those problems, but aestheticizes that problem. An approach to regeneration that sees regeneration and sees the city as nothing more than something to be consumed, to be gazed upon by a privileged audience. And that really is the sort of the very essence of what I'm saying here. Is regeneration about creating a city for the privileged members or people who live in those cities? For Williams, the Albert Dock is about superficial aesthetic thrills that offer no solutions. A strategic staging of culture that diverts attention from the real divided city that lay beyond the confines of the Albert Dock. So bringing the issue back to the question of the model, my question really is, how can a model such as that of the Corbett model offer solutions in a terrain that is so clearly place-specific? Now, Liverpool, like many other cities, is, you might say, industrially redundant. Its history, its industrial past is no longer sustainable. But much like any other city, its future success depends not on an abstract notion of the city, but on the specific needs of Liverpool. On the specific needs of any city that is inevitably the product of its own history. And it's in this way that I'm suggesting, or asking, in fact, is there any such thing as the city? Can we describe the city? Because inevitably it's reached a stage where the city, if it exists, only exists in a rhetorical way. Now, debates about regeneration might imply that the city has a social character. But ultimately, the way the city is currently constructed, the social dimension of the city has to be denied. It has to be pushed to one side. So much so because the city has become, or is perceived to be, a profit-making vehicle in which only some citizens of the city are able to have the keys to start the car. Regeneration is presented in a way that will inevitably exclude some members of that society. Another piece of work I would thoroughly recommend is my French is nearly as bad as my English. Brood Hugh. Anyway, that was wrong. But anyway, this is a really interesting book on regeneration in Beijing. And I think China is really interesting and can teach us a lot of lessons about the whole process, with it being so rapid, of what regeneration, the sort of negative as well as the positive aspects of regeneration. And the suggestion here is that the dog of regeneration, to use an English phrase, is being wagged by the tail. So regeneration is being pushed along without full attention to its more negative implications. So we get this idealised vision of a cappuccino sipping culture. And the quotation there: the ready-made identities assigned by city boosters and disseminated through the mass media often reduce several different visions of local culture into a single vision that reflects the aspirations of a powerful elite and the values, lifestyles and expectations of potential investors and tourists. These practices are thus highly elitist and exclusionary, and often signify to more disadvantaged segments of the population that they have no place in this revitalised and gentrified urban spectacle. So we're constructing this vision of this fantastic, spectacular, revitalised city, but by its very nature, that revitalised city will exclude vast numbers of actors, social and cultural groups, as Cliff discussed earlier on. So to use the way I sort of see the city then as sort of an entity that in itself is being consumed. Consumption, that being at the centre point of the contemporary city, is in danger of engulfing the whole notion of the city, so that the city effectively becomes nothing more than the pastiche of itself. That we create all these hundreds of different cities. You know, just walking around Krakow, you can see like the immense cultural identity, historical identity of the place. Through regeneration, we're not trying to rid cities of that history, but I think that city, that history will become harder and harder to come by worldwide because of this imposition of a model of regeneration. So the city becomes nothing more than this sort of visual tableau to be consumed. And the issue here is that the city is presented very much as a cultural democracy, as is consumption. It's often dressed up in the rhetoric of social inclusion. Regeneration is often presented as something that's pushed forward by social inclusion, but this cannot and is not the case. The city is presented as a place where anything is possible and anybody can aspire to be free if they can consume. So ultimately, you might think I'm very negative, and possibly I am, but my concern is that the model of regeneration that tends to be perpetuated is one in which there's no room for a heterogeneous city. That ultimately the city has to be uniform, it has to behave in a uniform way to succeed. And in Britain, this is very much connected to debates around the third way, which aims, on the one hand, to give socially and economically marginalised populations the opportunity to adapt to changing economic conditions, but by doing so in the process puts the blame at the feet of those individuals and makes no effort to deal with the core characteristics of the social injustice that's going on. So what happens here then is that a range of policy so-called solutions are presented to solve the questions of exclusion, when in fact there is no solution to the problem other than to blame individuals along the way. In terms of the Corbett model itself, 8 models of the city, or 8 sort of components, were presented as part of the overarching model. I want to sort of just throw into the ring the suggestion that these models or components underplay the key sociological dimensions of the city. and in particular the negative dimensions of a process that promotes a service-based city that will have inevitable negative repercussions. To borrow a phrase, and I'm not saying this is my position, but to borrow a phrase from the Frankfurt School, the way the contemporary city exists today, ultimately the diner of the city has to be satisfied with the menu. It seems to offer so much, but what it offers doesn't usually reach the majority of the people who might live in that city. And it is true to say that the development of the city, the process that lies behind the emerging city, remains largely mysterious. Because it's an ideological and rhetorical process, because there is no adequate research to understand the impact of regeneration. Obviously, loads of research has been done on regeneration, but particularly in the way I've described the city moving, there's a deep uncertainty about the effectiveness of such an approach. So the process that I've described, the sort of cautionary approach to the city, and one that is concerned about the negative implications of consumption, the repercussions of that approach to the city may not be reversible. They may certainly not be reversible by any model of the city. Maybe we've gone too far down that line to actually save the city, if I'm going to be slightly overdramatic. But what I would say is that without recourse to the cultural and historical dimensions of city life that are all too easily denied by a sort of modalistic approach to the city that promotes a particular view of that city, we're in danger of promoting a notion of the city at the expense of the specific idiosyncrasies of place. And that is really my fundamental point. How do you develop a model of the city that incorporates questions of place, and above all, how do you incorporate a model of the city, how do you develop a model of the city that incorporates the actors that live in those places? And I'll conclude at that point. Thank you.